This is case number 54735, Jackson versus State. Ms. Allen, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Jackson.
Sorry. May it please the court, counsel, and students and faculty of the Hebrew Academy. My name is Betsy Allen, and I represent Franklin Jackson, the appellant in this matter. I am requesting 5 minutes for rebuttal in this case. And there are three issues that I would be discussing today. The first of those issues is references to gangs and gang affiliation during the course of the trial. The second issue is Brady violations and withheld evidence from the state of Nevada. And the third issue is the issue of severance with the co-defendants prior to the start of trial. Just briefly, I have a couple of facts that I would like to put on the record as a basis for some of the arguments I'm going to make. This case for my clients started out much sooner than December of 2007. This started back into September of 2005. And he testified during the course of this trial that he was in the state of Louisiana and he watched his brother gunned down by an unknown assailant. His brother actually died in his arms, took his last breath, while Franklin held him. He decided from that point forward that he would carry a firearm. Good, bad, or indifferent, that was his decision. And 2 years later, in December of 2007, this had a serious effect on his state of mind and what he perceived happened to him that day. He was standing with a bunch of other teenagers. Mind you, at the time his brother died, he was 14. He was only 16 when this crime occurred. He was standing with a bunch of other teenagers, talking to some girls, and he hears someone scream, "The Mexicans have a gun." He sees people rushing at him, tearing their shirts off in a fighting stance. He hears what he perceives to be a gun, and he fires back. He actually tells the crowd, "Get out of the way, get out of the way," and he fires back at this crowd of Mexicans that he perceives are firing at him.
What was he doing with the gun?
He chose to carry a gun. As I stated before, his testimony was that after his brother was killed in Louisiana, he made the decision that he would protect himself and have a firearm. This is a child. He was 14 at the time his dad was killed, and he was only 16 when this happened. He's not, it's a 25-year-old adult with the skills to cope with this, not that anybody could, but that was his decision at the time, and that's what he testified to when he took the stand. He had been down there talking as he stated on the stand, he went down there to talk to some females. He just wanted to talk to girls. He was I think, at a bad place in his life at the time. So he'd gone down there with a couple of friends to talk to some girls that were getting off the bus stop. During the course of this trial, it started with jury selection. There were numerous instances of gangs brought up. The jury, sua sponte, brings up this issue of gangs, and I'm not sure why, because this case is not charged as a gang case. And as this court well knows, the state has the option to charge cases with a gang enhancement pursuant to NRS 193-168. The legislature has made it available to the state to bring in gang affiliation into cases. This case was not charged as such. Nonetheless, the jury brings this up, and during the course of jury selection in voir dire, questioning the jury, I attempt to stand up and I attempt to question these jurors with regard to this issue. There was an objection from the state, and we approached and we had a conversation with Judge Villani where Ms. Piper, co-counsel to Ms. Villegas, says, "You can't bring this up. This will result in a mistrial. This is unacceptable. We can't bring up
gangs." That's about anything about gangs.
Correct. And I told Judge Villani, at this point, if we don't cure this is a huge problem. If I don't properly voir dire this jury with regard to gangs, we're going to have a huge problem. I was limited in what I was allowed to do, and structurally at this point, we have error. The reason being is that all of the 14 members of the jury, 12 and two alternates that made it onto this panel, were not properly questioned with regard to gang affiliation, with regard to their thoughts on gangs. And this is a subject that comes up time and time again. It's associated naturally with violence. This was a violent crime. And throughout the course of the trial, we had numerous instances where people brought up gangs. Most notably, the two things that happened that were of concern were a crime scene analyst specifically said that she was talking to a gang detective about whatever procedure she needed to do at this point. And the second instance that was most notable was the state publishing a picture to the jury that at the top said Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department gang unit.
Did anybody ask for any type of limiting instruction or curative instruction?
Justice Cherry, I apologize. I don't believe that there was a limiting instruction given. However, I would say it was incumbent on Judge Villani to give an instruction curing these issues.
Ms. Allen, was Mr. Jackson identified as a gang member at any time?
He was not. He was not identified as a gang member. But when he took the stand, Ms. Villegas attempted to get an information that he was a gang member. The court actually never made a ruling on whether or not that information was subject to cross-examination by Ms. Villegas because she decided that she didn't want to argue it anymore and she had had enough.
Did you move for a mistrial when the gang information came up?
Multiple times, Justice Cherry, multiple times. I asked for a mistrial when the jury first mentioned it. I asked for a mistrial when the picture was put up. I asked for a mistrial when the CSA mentioned it. I think I must have asked for at least five mistrials during the course of this trial.
As a point of information, not related to your argument, I'm presuming that my presiding judge will give additional time. When you seek a limiting instruction or move for a mistrial,
yes,
and your concern about gang affiliation is, in a nutshell, what? That people are in some way biased, prejudiced? What would be the nature of it?
Absolutely, Justice. The problem is that because the jury brought this up sua sponte, it was not brought up by either side. The jury just randomly brings up this issue of gangs and gang violence, and that's the problem. It's not just gangs. The natural progress for the average citizen, I believe, goes from gangs to gang violence. They assume naturally gangs and violence are synonymous with one another.
How'd they bring it up?
I believe during the questioning of one of the jurors, I believe, have you ever been the victim of a crime? And I believe that's how it came up. It's a standard question that's asked of jurors. Are you ever the victim of a crime? And they brought it up and said, yes, my brother was violently attacked by a gangbanger. And that brought it up. And that leads to other jurors making comments. That's just the natural progress of voir dire.
And did the judge say anything at that time during voir dire about the gang?
He did not. He didn't say anything. And once again, I attempted to cure it through my voir dire and my questioning of the jury, and I was limited. I was not allowed to do that. Again, I believe, therefore, in paneling potentially a jury pool that was biased against my client, and it results in a structural error with regard to the trial.
And okay, there is a bias that you can establish based upon something of this nature. A mistrial would mean that the trial is done over to start
correct
again.
Correct, Judge. Justice, yes, I apologize. Yes, if it was a mistrial, what would happen is the jury would be dismissed and we would have to impanel an entire new jury.
Do-over,
essentially. We cited Coleman in our brief, which relates to the issue of mentioning that a defendant has been in jail. And the distinguishing issue here is this. I think people naturally assume that when you are accused of a crime, you're arrested. The mention of being in jail or being arrested comes nowhere close to the idea of being in a gang. The idea of being in a gang is naturally associated with violence. And there's a distinguishing issue with regard to Coleman. Excuse me. If I can move on to the...
Severance, please. Talk to us about severance first.
Okay, severance? Yes, Justice Cherry. We requested... I take that back. Joel Mann was the original attorney on this case, and he requested a severance at the outset, which was denied.
What is a severance?
That is when a defendant requests to be tried on his own and not with his co-defendants. There are certain prejudices that come with trying co-defendants together. Potentially statements are made by one or the other. Potentially, there could be evidence that's admissible against one that's not admissible against the other, and it results in prejudice. Joel Mann requested a severance in this case. It was denied. Subsequent to this, Chartier came out, and Chartier was a Supreme Court decision that dealt directly with severance. Chartier said that you can request a severance up into even, I think, during the course of the trial. It says that if there are mutually antagonistic defenses, then the defense has the right to request a severance, and it should be granted. The problem...
Excuse me, the Joel Mann file a motion for severance, or how did he raise the issue?
He filed a motion for severance, yes. And I believe that it was raised again orally prior to the start of trial by myself and Mr. Hu, and again, it was denied. The problem with the defenses in this case are this. Dresden Williams, the co-defendant, claimed he was merely present at the scene of the crime. My client, Mr. Jackson, claimed that this was self-defense. These two individuals came from drastically different backgrounds, drastically different. There was no evidence that Dresden Williams had gone through what Mr. Jackson had gone through. He set this out when he got on the stand and said, my brother was killed in a flurry of gunfire. I watched him do a 360 in the air. I ran back to him, bleeding all over me, all of these things. He clearly remembered from his testimony what happened to his brother, this horrible experience. The perception of harm that my client had versus the perception or lack thereof that Dresden Williams has or had at the time created mutually antagonistic defenses.
Well, my understanding of the defenses was Mr. Williams was just present there, and that Mr. Jackson was saying the shooting was in self-defense and like that. So they seem like totally different theories. I'm confused why they're conflicting.
Well, that's the perception. I believe it's a state of mind and perception of harm, Justice. What I'm saying is that Dresden doesn't have this perception of harm. He doesn't have the life experience. And self-defense deals with the subjective individual. It deals with, is there a reasonable basis for this person to believe they are in harm's way? The problem is there's no indication that Dresden felt anything. He was just present. He didn't take the stand. There was no testimony from him. Mr. Jackson got on the stand, and he described his perception of harm. When the jury goes back to deliberate this, when they go back to discuss this, how can they not confuse these two defenses? How can they not confuse what happened here? And when they look at Dresden Williams and say, well, Mr. Williams clearly had no perception of harm, he obviously didn't think anything was happening, how could Mr. Jackson not feel the same way? And at this point, they've confused the defenses, and guilt overlaps in this regard with regard to Mr. Jackson.
You can move on to Brady.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice Cherry. With regard to the Brady violation, we allege that this note, and it wasn't just the note, was not handed over to the defense. The note was part of it. The other part of it was an article was in the Las Vegas Sun shortly after the conviction in this case, summing up his gang detective Andre Carter going to the mother, Tina Richardson, who was the author of the note, day after day, hour after hour, repeatedly calling her. And there was no police reports. There was no indication any of this happened. It didn't come through with the grand jury testimony. It didn't come through in any of the testimony taken by anyone. We never knew about it. Mr. Jackson, we never knew about it. This was material information for particularly for this reason. And the state cites this in their responding brief. Ajahnay, who's Tina Richardson's mother, told her mother that there were hundreds of Hispanics. This was in the note, hundreds of Hispanics. When she testified at trial, she said there was a few. When you have a self-defense issue that Mr. Jackson clearly had here, the difference between hundreds and a few makes a world of difference. Had we had the note been presented to the defense, certainly there would have been cross-examination on it. Certainly there would have been impeachment on it. And certainly that could have made a remarkable difference in how the jury perceived my client's assertions of self-defense.
Yeah.
I did not see it in there, no. I did not. This is frequently a problem for the defense, the open file policy. There are things we don't get. In fact, in this case, there was a few instances of discovery issues where we didn't receive what we were supposed to receive. The trial was continued. Judge Villani actually ordered discovery in this case, which I would cite Jimenez discusses, the trial court ordering full discovery in this case, and that covers specific instances of discovery requests. And unfortunately, we didn't receive the note. The fact that Mr. Hu, Dresden Williams' attorney, received the note does not mean that we did. And certainly, having been doing this almost a decade, I mean, certainly those questions would have come up with regard to Ajahnay. Ajane was the only witness who clearly identified my client, said his name, said he was the one who was shooting the gun. She was the only one. If she had said to her mother at some point, hundreds versus a few, I think that would have come up in cross-examination, and it clearly didn't if the, you know, if the court looked at the record and the testimony of Ajane.
I'll give you some extra time.
Okay, thank you.
District Attorney Blake, your office, representing the state of Nevada.
May it please the court, counsel. First of all, let's I'd like to address regarding the note. The note was in the binder. The defense attorney had access to that binder. I gave her the binder, and she flipped through each page. It is not my duty to tell her, oh, are you sure you have this page, and go through each one of the pieces of paper that's in my binder. Secondly, I did provide that same packet of discovery to the defense attorney and to Ms. Allen, for her to suddenly indicate to me that she never received that note until when the state filed its response to the motion for new trial.
Would you tell students about what does open file mean, open file policy?
Open file policy means that, as I indicated earlier, the district attorney has to provide all of the documents to the defense and have an opportunity for the defense attorney to come to the office, look at the files of the district attorney that's going to be in preparation for the trial. So as opposed to actually giving her just the files, what I usually do in my cases is I Xerox my file and then put it in a organized fashion in my binder. So it's all tabulated. It indicates what are the exhibits I'm going to be using for trial and the witnesses and the order of the witnesses I'm going to be presenting, since the state always has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt the guilt of the accused in this case. So Ms. Allen came to my office numerous times, once with her law clerk, second or third time with her investigator, and reviewed my binder, every one of them, and copied and made tabulations of which one she didn't have and which one she did have, and compared it with her documents. So as far as that note is concerned, as I indicated in my argument to Judge Villani, the essence or the information on that note was from Tina Richardson, who wasn't even present at the time of the shooting. She received the information from Ajane, and it's interesting to note that in respondent's appendix, page 337, it was in Ajane's direct examination when I was questioning Ajane regarding the events that took place that day. She was the one who actually informed the jury that right before the shooting, she saw these Hispanics on the other side. She came up to one of the defendant's friends, Farad, as well as the defendant, said hello, and then at that point, Farad pushed her across the street, and then she heard someone, not indicating who it was, she couldn't say who it was, but someone said Hispanics had a weapon. Didn't say Hispanics had a gun, it says Hispanics had a weapon.
So she testified to that at the trial?
Yes, she testified to that, and that was elicited from Ajane at direct examination, so my questioning to Ajane. Now, in addition to that evidence, we also had Wesley Carr. Wesley Carr, in Respondent's Appendix, page 330, on cross-examination of Ms. Allen upon this witness, she asked him, did you see any of the Hispanics with guns? His response was, I seen one with a pocket knife, like just through their pockets. Never really indicated that the pocket knife was ever revealed, but that person, as he was explaining, Wesley Carr was explaining, that person had already passed him. He was going in a different direction, so he never really saw the movement of what that Hispanic was doing. The other thing that's that the audience should realize is when these witnesses were testifying, it's not as if it's a close distance between the defendant's group as well as the Hispanic groups. In looking at the courtroom, it went beyond the court doors, and I know all three justices are quite aware of the distance at the RJC, but we're looking at a distance from where I'm standing to possibly where the doors are that leads into this auditorium. It was more than half a block on Alexander when this shooting took place. So that was a distance from the Hispanic groups and the African-American groups where the defendant was in company of.
Ms. Blakes, a question regarding severance. Because of the nature of this crime and the number of people who witnessed or were a part of the process, wouldn't it have been better to try these two individuals separately?
Judge, what's interesting is when Joel Mann filed that motion to sever, if you look closely to his motion, it was not the severance between these two cousins, Franklin Jackson and Dresden Williams. It was a severance between these individuals with Nico Tatum. Nico Tatum at the time was also charged with the shooting because at that point, some of the witnesses indicated Nico Tatum was a shooter, even though we had evidence that there were only two shooters involved because everybody saw only two people shooting. Now the question becomes, who were the actual shooters? So when the Nico Tatum was then apprehended in Denver, Colorado, days after this incident, he indicated and confessed that I wasn't involved in this shooting. However, I was involved in another shooting that happened 3 days before this incident. The two people that you want is Franklin Jackson and or Dubert is what he made reference to. And at that point, that's when we also switched then gears regarding we may have the wrong individuals, but even though Nico Tatum provided the motive as to why the shooting took place, he was aiding and abetting in this whole situation, so that's how I pled and charged this case. So when Mr. Mann was filing that motion to sever, he didn't want that piece of evidence, that confession of Nico Tatum coming in because of the Bruton issue, meaning if the jury wouldn't be able to separate the confession of this one particular individual and may impugn liability against the other two who did not confess to the shooting. And that's the other thing. When this case was tried, both defendants, Franklin Jackson and Dresden Williams, both indicated to the detective they were not even present at the shooting. They even distanced themselves from being at the Walnut and Alexander area at the school bus stop. So suddenly, of course, when other people are identifying them, in this case, Agenet, yes, Agenet was the only one who could identify Dresden Williams. However, Agenet was not the only one who could make an identification on the shooter. We also have one of the Hispanic group, Andy Sardinas, who was shown a photo lineup, and that, and he made an identification at the time, 75% sure Franklin Jackson was one of the people shooting at the crowd at them. So as a result of that information, then that was the basis for our search warrant to Franklin Jackson's girlfriend's mother's house that led us to the grandmother's house. Now, with respect to the references of gangs, and I'd like to bring that up because in the first instance, the person that testified first that counsel is claiming prejudice on was Amy Nemczyk, the crime scene analyst. Amy Nemczyk testified on June 23, 2009 in Respondents Appendix 137. And it was in Ms. Allen's cross-examination of Amy Nemczyk asking her, who did you speak with as far as any detectives that day? And Ms. Nemczyk replied, I do not recall that there were detectives from several different units present. Ms. Allen's next question, who was specifically, I guess, giving you directions and where to go and photograph things? And that's when Ms. Nemczyk indicated, we spoke with, I believe, representatives from the gang unit and possibly from violent crimes. There were also some segregated problem-solving unit detectives out there, patrol units, and these are exact words. So these are, the information wasn't elicited by the state. It was elicited by Ms. Allen. In addition, as a result of that information, Judge Volani indicated that and ruled that this is a fleeting comment, motion for mistrial was denied. And as a result, because she basically was naming the people that were there and who were present and who she spoke to. Now, with respect to Wesley Carr making the comment of the gang unit, This was, yes, it was on the state's examination. And in this case, it was basically talking about the photo lineups, because in these photo lineups, Exhibits 72 and 73, Wesley Carr was identifying not Franklin Jackson, not Dresden Williams, but the co-defendant, Nico Tatum. Even though Nico Tatum was not part of this jury trial because he already pled guilty to these charges, so his whole thing was separated, and that's why the severance became moot at that point. With Wesley Carr, my co-counsel was asking in Respondent Appendix page 323, tell me about these photo lineups. Carr said, well, they came to my house, woke me up, the first photo lineup, I could not point anybody out. And so it went on. And then they came again, and they woke me up again. And so Ms. Piper asked, well, let me ask you this. Were you kind of upset that they woke you up again? And he goes, yeah, I was not happy. I was in a dead sleep. I was trying to get my rest. And so Ms. Piper asked, and so they woke you up and they wanted to talk to you? Yes, it was a gang unit. That was the only reference that was made by Wesley Carr. And at that point, Ms. Piper didn't ask any more questions, passed the witness, and Ms. Allen then made a motion for mistrial on that part.
Did anybody talk about a curative instruction?
Judge, no. We didn't ask about a curative, but I would like to go into the photo lineups, because the judge did do, and what happened in these photo lines with Regina Boosley, was it wasn't Las Vegas gang unit that was on the exhibit photo lineups 77 and 78. It referred to the location where this lineup took place, and it says gang crime sec, period. So it means gang crime section was where the lineup took place with the interview with Regina Boosley. And in that instance, when the state presented the admission of these evidence, both counsel, Ms. Allen and Mr. Hu, said no objection. So the photo lineups were admitted. Now, when it came to publish, what Ms. Piper was trying to do was focus on the statement by the witness, Regina Boosley, the handwritten statement. So at first, she showed on the monitor the entire first page of the lineup, and then at that point, then zeroed in to the statement. Well, when they immediately saw a gang crime sec, they immediately asked to approach the bench. We approached, made our argument, and then put it on the record. And so the court ruled under Respondent's Appendix 386, Judge Villana mentioned how the defense said no objection. However, what he decided to do was we were going to redact that portion, so the exhibit was not going to be presented to the jury with that gang crime sect, and instead I had to recopy that first page of those two exhibits without the location, and then present the rest of the exhibit to the jury. And that's exactly what happened in this case. So if anything, we've had a comment from the crime scene analyst Nemsik, and we have a comment by Wesley Carr as who he spoke to regarding the photo lineups of Nico Tatum. Now, with respect to the jury questionnaire voir dire, this is the first time I'm ever hearing about this from Ms. Allen, because it was never indicated in her appeal. But as she was questioning the jury at the time, or the particular juror at the time when the statement was being made regarding is this gang related or something to that effect, and the judge Villani was able to tell her to go on, and even though we did approach the bench, however, rectified it, and by her questioning some more further questions, but limited to exactly to what extent she was going to say. Now, in this whole trial, nothing was mentioned about his gang affiliation. Even when he took the stand and admitted, Franklin Jackson took the stand and admitted regarding him having guns. Why does he need guns? I could not even go into a field interview card that he was involved in 8 months prior to this, where he was with other known gang members. So it was being investigated regarding a shooting at that particular incident. The judge just limited me to my cross-examination, even though I felt that the defendant has placed his character in evidence. I could not even question him beyond what was happening on the day of the crime, which is on December 11th. And so the defendant Jackson indicated that he wasn't even there the day before when the fight took place that gave the motive to possibly the shooting. So I was trying to try and figure out, well, what was your relationship with Nico Tatum, and why was it suddenly you're there the next day with guns? And why was it that you suddenly decided that you're going to use this gun and fire upon this crowd of kids as they're getting off the school bus stop? And after looking at all the evidence, the state feels that the judgment of conviction should be affirmed. There's no error. If any of the error could be harmless in nature. And with that, the state would thank. Thank you.
Ms. Allen, I'm going to give you 3 minutes to rebut.
With regard to the note that was allegedly in the binder, Ms. Villegas claims that it's not her duty to pass on this information, that it's my duty to go over and look at her file and make sure that I have everything. I think this is completely contrary to Brady versus Maryland and Kyles v. Whitley and its progeny. And our state has adopted those cases through Roberts v. State, in that it is the affirmative duty of the state to provide this information to us. That note was exculpatory. That note had information about Ajahnay Richardson. She was the one and only person who said Frank Jackson is the one who committed this offense. She actually saw it. She said it was him. And certainly cross-examining her with regard to how many people were running at him when he fired upon this crowd was pertinent to a self-defense claim. In addition to that, Andre Carter and all of the time he spent with Tina Richardson and all of the investigation that he did on this case, and there was not one mention of him in any report, in any grand jury testimony, in anything that was provided to the defense, not one. I had no notice going into this trial that Detective Andre Carter had so much to do with this case. Certainly, that is a huge issue. And the actual investigative detective on this case was never even put on the stand. We couldn't even get in touch with him. They put on another detective who had much less to do with this case. With regard to the idea that the gang references, there were three references to this, including the picture. But I would point to the court to the respondent's appendix, pages 147 through 149, where I specifically talk about Ms. Piper objecting to gang references coming in. The fact that, and let me correct this too, with regard to Ms. Villegas' assertion that Judge Villani ruled against her in bringing in the FI cards, field interview cards. He did not. She gave up. She actually stood up and said, and this is Respondent's Appendix, pages 506 to 510, she said, you know what, I give up. I don't want to deal with this anymore. Forget it. I won't go into it. So we never actually got to a ruling on that. But the fact that she had the opportunity originally to charge this case as a gang case and chose not to, and then on the tail end of it, certainly just because my client took the stand, suddenly she's allowed to go into gang affiliation, it boggles the mind. Certainly, SOME came out, FI cards come in, we have to have a hearing, there was no hearing. It would have been reversible error to bring those in against him just based on SOME. With regard to the assertions about Ajahnay's statements, the Mexicans have a weapon, and she said there was clear testimony in this trial. Someone shouted out, the Mexicans have a gun. The state says in their opposition, it's just a weapon. It was clearly a gun. There was testimony, a jackhammer was going off at the same time. Absolutely could have been confused with gunfire, which would, go back to my client's assertions of self-defense. Go ahead.
even if we were to assume that the note was improperly withheld, and take the next step in the analysis, which is that it would have been exculpatory in nature, how do you respond to the question that it appears as if bullet casings were recovered at the scene of the shooting, matched guns that were found in the room where your client stayed, fingerprints were found on guns, and, of course, the admission of the infected fire? How does this become pertinent?
Well, Well, I would argue, this is how I would respond to that, Justice Ada, in that he admits that he did this. Obviously, he claims self-defense. So the fact that there were fingerprints on the gun and the gun was found with him, well, that would make sense. The fact that we were not given this note, and again, I don't want to separate the note from the idea of Andre Carter, because it's sort of one and the same. All of this was discovered by us in that article in the Las Vegas Sun. All of that information should have been over, and certainly, again, I go back to the idea that if she told her mother there were hundreds of Mexicans, Hispanics, but she said Mexicans, rushing at my client, hundreds versus a few certainly makes a huge difference.
State of mind.
Of course. And again, it, you know, the two, I have to, I mean, the two references with regard to the severance and this note are sort of connected in that how can the jury not confuse the idea of Dresden's, Williams's mere presence versus my client's perception of the harm that is coming at him. So I think the two are very closely connected in that regard.
Any further questions, Justice Gibbons, Justice Ada? Thank you, Ms. Allen.
This case
stands submitted. And I'd like to thank both counsel for their presentations and their briefs in this matter.